Welcome to the Clarity Fun Podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and I'm joined with Dr. Kelly Burton. And we've been doing a series that was about the Contemporary Academy. We've been chatting about that. We're both in the Contemporary Academy, and we're both interested in what's going on. And we had talked in a previous podcast about advice to young philosophers. And we're sort of building on that now as we think about a young student entering the academy. What challenges will they expect to find, and how can they best address those challenges? So, Dr. Burton, why don't you start us off? Tell us what you've been reading and thinking about.
Hi, Dr. Anderson. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about critical theory lately. You and I have had conversations about that as well. And something came to mind as I was thinking about critical theory is, what happened to the love of ideas? I've been thinking about that. It seems to me that philosophy is about ideas and examining ideas and playing out the logical implications of ideas, but it doesn't seem like a popular thing to do anymore.
Tell us about it. What are you seeing?
I'm seeing an emphasis on activism. The time for, we've mentioned this, the time for talking is over, the time for action is now. And I'm thinking not a lot of people are thinking through the implications of this activism. And I think this is something that students are going to encounter when they go to the university. It's everywhere. Yeah.
It seems like the idea is that what makes a meaningful life is one that somehow produces change in the world, addressing perceived injustices.
Yes, I think you're
right. You have to have your cause. If you don't have your cause, you're not really doing anything with yourself.
But let's think about that. This idea of justice is an old idea in the history of philosophy, and it's a contested idea. And it seems like we need to take time to think through that idea. And that's just one idea that's being acted upon right now.
Yeah, it's something like, I wonder, is it a version of love your neighbor that's been emptied of critical thought?
Yeah, you know, I think it could be. But
so you're supposed to love your neighbor, and incidentally, that's the second of the commandments. The first one is that you're to love the Lord your God. So it's almost like a secular version, which of course the secular then has to jettison the love the Lord your God commandment and just do the love your neighbor commandment. And then the idea is, well, I wouldn't want to be treated unfairly. And so if I think someone else has been treated unfairly, then I should try to do something about it.
And now you've brought in another concept, fairness and love. And these are things we need to think through. I agree with you. I think this is what it's about. And I think it's a good virtue for us to love our neighbor. But I also think philosophy has gotten a little off track. Is it the job of philosophy to be activist? Or is it the job of philosophy to provide a foundation for activism?
Well, I wonder, I think you and I have talked about the foundation, so I think, yes, definitely. Without the foundation, then what we call activism might actually be bringing about harm.
Yes.
So we might claim that we're loving our neighbor and we're actually bringing them about harm. We're doing something that appears to be help and it isn't actually help. Or we're perceiving what we call unfairness and it really actually isn't unfair. But I do wonder, though, if philosophy does want to change the world. And so that intuition of wanting to do something with your life, to make your life count, is an important human intuition. But it could just as easily be that you make things worse. They only appear to be better. Because it seems like a lot of what people want to do to make the world better has to do with money.
Yeah.
For example, a more equal distribution of money, more access to money, the ability to have money so you can have political influence. And if a good life doesn't really have much at all to do with how much money you have, then that's all misguided.
Right. And so you just brought up the good life. We're talking about ethics. Really, this activism is ethics. And I'm not sure we have a firm foundation for ethics right now. And so are we free to back up and think it through? Right. Or do we just have to get on this train and go?
Well, I wonder, too, if there's been a number of these cycles in American history, revivalist movements. And perhaps what makes this current one different is that it is secular, only secular. But all of the revivalist movements had a religious and a social impact.
Yeah, so I think you're right.
I wonder if there's a larger pattern in American religious thought, and this is fitting into that. Maybe the last one was the Billy Graham revivals. And then that takes a while to kind of feel all the impact of that. But that still obviously was religious.
Yeah.
So are we allowed to think about this? Is a secular revival even worth joining? That seems like a good question.
That's a deep one. And can we stop and back up and say, what exactly am I joining? And what, this is what I'm saying, that there's a role for thinking here and ideas. What if it has a negative impact?
Right.
I mean, what are we doing here? So backing up to what I started with is, I think philosophy students, philosophy majors, philosophers need a love for ideas first. And those ideas are what drive action. So we should probably think things through, have rational justification, and backing up even further, self-examination. We need to think about our own views and why we think those views are true.
Yeah. Well, tell us, what should we back up and examine? Cash that out for us a little more.
I think some of the things we've mentioned, what is justice? What does it mean to love your neighbor? What is the good life? But I think even more, I'm always pushing, backing up and doing metaphysics. And before that, even epistemology. How can we even know? What is the method for knowing and justifying our actions? And those are the basic questions in philosophy. And if you don't love doing that, then probably you shouldn't be a philosophy major.
Now, I think there might be some terms, though, that are used because their very definition is something negative. So if you were to question them, you'd be looked at like you're crazy. So, for example, I'll just give some generic examples, but you might be able to see the application. If someone was to say, I love injustice, well, that'd be weird, right? I mean, injustice is a negative thing. And so sometimes what people might pick up in their activism would be something like that, right? We're for, let's say, love. And by implication, the other side is for not love or hatred.
Yeah.
So part of the questioning has to be even in the names and the words that are chosen to say, is that really what love is? Or is that really what justice is?
Right.
So if you're told that an institution is unjust from top to bottom, institutional unfairness. Well, are we sure? What exactly does it mean for something to be fair or just or good?
Right. And so that seems to be the first step in critical thinking. Not critical theory, not critique, but critical thinking. What does that mean? And can we agree upon the meaning of terms? And does the meaning of terms name something in reality? I think that's the very thing that's under question right now.
Yeah. I talked to you about an example of this in Stephen Hawking. And I contrast him with something that I read in John Locke, where John Locke says he's never met anyone so unreasonable as to say the manifest contradiction that something came from nothing. But then Stephen Hawking, in his last book, which means his most mature book, at the end of the book says, we can say the universe came from nothing.
Yeah.
And one of the things, besides that, just the obvious error in that, what I notice about that is, here we have someone who's reputed by his generation to have been the smartest human who ever lived. What does that say about the people handing out that award?
Yeah.
That they think the award of smartest human ever goes to someone who says, well, Locke pointed out, this is a manifest contradiction. And so it made me think about the emptying of words. This was right. What brought it to my mind right now is the word nothing has been emptied of meaning. He actually goes on to talk about how there's gravity doing it, and gravity is not nothing. And so we've emptied words like that. And because of that, we can't make any progress on even very basic foundational things.
Doesn't it seem like this is the heart of the problem, that words don't name things or realities? We can't get to reality. And thus we kind of invent reality and push it out on others in a kind of power play.
Well, that is the whole story, right? And then there's just the various power plays, and we should equip the marginalized power groups so they have more power. And it all becomes like that, and ideas and the truth of the matter is lost because we've already agreed to this. And I know you and I have both referred to Confucius and his job of the rectification of names.
Yes, I love that.
He didn't think that order could be restored until names name things that they mean.
Exactly, and he thought that was the job of the philosophers.
And I think more recently, George Orwell pointed that out in 1984.
Yeah.
That the government changes the meaning of words in order to get you to agree with them and control the masses.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of subjectivism there that, well, whoever's in charge of the words, that's who's in power. But that's not true, because nothing is nothing. It always will be. And just because we change the name of it and tell people something comes from nothing, it doesn't make it so. And so what happened, as you've asked, to thinking for ourselves, or what happened to our ability to use reason?
Yeah. And I think some bold young philosophers need to step up and say, why should I believe that? Why? And that takes a kind of freedom, a kind of, well, I think it's a search for meaning, and people who really desire meaning will say, why should I believe that?
Yeah, I think so. Well, and part of the difficulty is that I guess maybe people think that when you have to stand up for something, you're standing up against an opponent who is embracing evil. Maybe because the movies present villains that way.
Yeah.
And it's very simple. Like, okay, that guy says he's going to hurt everyone, so I have to stop him. But in real life, that's not how it works. The other side says, we're standing up for law and order. And your side has to say, no, you're not. This is actually a matter of freedom. I'm thinking about the American Revolution.
Yeah.
So the British didn't think of themselves as oppressing the colonists. That's not how they would have phrased it. They would have said, we're maintaining order in the empire. And so you have to be willing to look at it and see what really is going on.
Yeah.
And in this case, the word justice especially is being used. And I think it's because of a certain view of what a life is like. And if in this life you're prevented from certain kinds of activities, I said if, because it may not even be the case, that's true. But if you are, what does that say about if you could have lived a good life or not? And I think for you and I, maybe we're more comfortable because if Socrates is our teacher, our mentor, so to speak, he died in debt.
Yeah.
So I don't think that you and I are probably too concerned about that on one level. And so our focus, our shift is completely different.
You know, there's something else that's happening that I think we can go back to Socrates. He wasn't afraid to die. I think we're living in a time where a lot of people are afraid to die. And it's because of our metaphysics, again. This is the only life you have, and it's very short, and there's a dangerous virus out there. So there is something to an urgency for the people living right now, if this is the only life you have.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny you mention that because we have a parallel podcast series going on anxiety.
Yeah.
And this is particularly existential anxiety. And at the root of that is the fear of death.
Yeah.
And death as the ultimate callback. And having no answer in the face of death, you're not able to give it any meaning, creates a whole life of anxiety from top to bottom.
That's true.
So I would think that those might go together, right? The meaninglessness of words coupled with the reality of death, and you can't explain things. You can't give meaning to your life. And so you might try to find meaning in one of these causes.
Yes.
But even that is arbitrary because you could have picked any one of 100 other causes. And then we all still end up dead in the end.
Kind of related to that, I have a question for you. Do you think young people may be finding meaning in causes when previously they may have found meaning in religion, like you were talking about the revivals? Is this how people are finding meaning, joining some cause?
Yeah, it certainly seems so, like a secular cause.
What happens when
make the world better?
What happens a few years down the line when people find out that wasn't really that meaningful and they wasted that time?
Yeah, that's the terrible cost of it. Not monetary cost, but a cost of time and meaning.
Yeah.
I think the some of the idealism of the 60s is like that, right?
Where
we look back now and it's kind of cringy.
Yes, that's what I had in mind when I brought this up.
But I think there's something... Oh, go ahead.
You're circling around this idea of meaning of words, meaning of life. It does seem like that's at the heart of it, right?
Yeah, well, I think so. That comes back to your focus on ideas. And I think it's put this way in some areas, they would say a sense of wonder.
Yeah.
Interesting. I think that's how Aristotle and Aquinas define the beginning of philosophy.
Yes.
Now, I would put it differently, building on the series I was doing on existential anxiety. Because a sense of wonder is a kind of a positive term that reflects good on us. Makes us like, look, I wonder, I care about knowing. The preacher said that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord.
Yes.
Solomon. And Solomon was reputed for his wisdom. And so I think that is a little different than wonder, because wonder could just be like, I'm really curious about lots of things in the world. And the fear of the Lord might sound too religious. You say, well, wait, I'm an atheist. I don't even believe there is a Lord. But I think he's getting at something in about reality, which is that wisdom begins with our need to make sense of things. And not just anything, but the most important things.
Yes.
And that these ideas aren't just abstract, like Aristotle's God, who's just basically an abstract idea to us. The Lord, that term Lord means God who's ruling redemptively.
Yeah.
God who's actively involved. And so wisdom begins at that point. Once you've reasoned to that point is when wisdom begins. And that might take some steps to get there. And you say, well, I've done a lot of work. I know, but you only got to where it begins.
And wouldn't you say that fear of the Lord is also connected to fear of meaninglessness in a
yes.
way? It's so I'm afraid of a meaningless life.
Yeah.
And so the flip side of that would be pursue meaning.
Yeah. Well, and notice how that connects up well with the greatest commandment. Because we were talking earlier about love your neighbor, which is the second commandment. The greatest commandment is this: love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And so that
yeah.
commandment and then the beginning of wisdom are clearly saying something very similar. So
yeah,
what happens if you go about loving your neighbor, but you don't fear the Lord? Do you plan for things to work out well?
That's a good
even
question. I was just going to ask
right.
that.
Yeah. Like, let's say even if you're right about what it means to love your neighbor, which I have a big question mark next to. Bless his grant. Okay, you got it right. You're doing what you should to love your neighbor. But you reject God. Like, how far is that going to get you?
I think it's not going to get very far. Humans are humans. Obviously, we're not loving each other as we ought to now. What will make it better?
Yeah.
What will change it?
Yeah, love apart from the love of God doesn't seem like it'll get there. Now, someone can say, look, you've made too many jumps because I don't even grant there is a God.
And, well, let's and talk
fine.
About that. That's
yeah,
what
yeah,
philosophy is about.
That's what I was going to say, yeah. Let's do it, then. That's good. Let's get into questioning, well, what are the alternatives to that? That's what I love about, I mentioned earlier, John Locke, and the quote I have from him when he says that there's no greater absurdity than saying everything came from nothing. He says, so therefore we know something existed from eternity, and now we need to figure out what it is.
Yeah.
So that's the first step. Yeah, we know something is eternal. Now, what is it?
And that's when it gets exciting.
Yeah, I think I think that would be, how is that for activism? Awakening people to the love of wisdom.
Yeah, I'll live for that. That's my cause.
And it may not put any more dollars in their wallet, but it has something more valuable than that.
Yes. Meaning?
So, yeah, meaning, right. And what if you say, well, I continue to be treated unfairly in this life. I know, that's kind of the story of Socrates, right?
Yes.
I mentioned he died in death, but he was also treated unfairly at his trial and given a really bad verdict. And it's interesting, he doesn't complain at all. His students complain. His students said, hey, let's break you out of here. And he doesn't complain at all. He actually talks about how he could be excited to go to the next life and ask people questions there.
Yeah.
So I think that... Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
He has a different interpretive framework for suffering, let's say.
Yeah. I think so. That's what I was going to get at, is that if we change how we're thinking about good and evil, it changes how we evaluate some of these present causes or present approaches to life, secular causes.
Yeah.
So all this wraps up into our topic, which was, what would you do if you're a young student? I mean, it seems like we count as old because we say things like, man, when I was a student, it wasn't like this. But I think there's sufficient similarities to say, well, when I was a student, people had ideas that they tried to promote, and I had to learn how to question things.
Yeah. I think one of the things that may have been different when we were students is a different generation, and we weren't as connected socially, and it didn't matter as much what our peer group was thinking. I think we may have had more freedom to think our own thoughts than we do now.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good point. Of, I know in my case, I didn't really, that didn't weigh very heavily on me, what my peers thought.
Yeah, I was pretty much hanging out by myself, doing my own thing. I didn't care about my peers.
I think it's a hallmark of Generation X. So that could be true. Yeah. And other generations are more concerned about that, and the hallmark of their generation is social media.
Yeah, so they may be facing a different challenge than we faced, or an additional challenge, and we should maybe consider that. Maybe get off the social media and think a little bit.
Yeah, well, I wonder if that sounds like an old person, like, stop watching so much TV.
Maybe the old people were right, though.
Yeah, turn down that music. Get a haircut. So I think that that could be true, but we need to think about how do we do that? How do we once we turn it off, do we even have the tools with which to think? Or has that part of our education be bypassed?
Yeah. No, I think that's a more serious problem.
So as we wrap up this one, Dr. Burton and I are discussing advice to young students, and part of this has just been thinking about the climate we live in and what's happened to words as they become used meaninglessly emptied of meaning, emptied of content, and we're not able to think critically. So the solution to that would be we need to learn how to do that.
Yes.
And I think we're going to have follow-up discussions on that. So thank you, Dr. Burton.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson.